Yeah, first of all, just to thank you all for attending, particularly on this horrible day, and I hope to make your evening worthwhile and informative or challenging, stimulating, and hopefully you'll leave with a few ideas which you may or may not agree with, but might give you a bit more to think through. I also want to thank Paul Senior and the Sheffield Hallam Community Justice Centre. It's good to be associated with the centre, and I appreciate the invitation and privilege to be here this evening. There couldn't be a better time to be exploring and thinking about what drug policy reform might look like. And it's exciting for me to be here at this time. After 3 decades of working in the drugs field as a probation officer, a drugs worker, a researcher, an academic, I'm really seeing little change or progress in the drug policy and practice. I'm delighted to see that there is some major change happening at this time. Well, this isn't behaving funny, but I'll use it that way. There are a growing number of organisations globally thinking that there is a time now for some sort of change to occur. But what will this change and this reform look like? And I think these are actually very critical times and important times. They're not times to get overexcited or giddy or intoxicated with power or change. I think we need to be quite cautious. I think we need to be quite careful about how we steer this change. Otherwise, we will fail to address the fundamental issues. And what I hope to do this evening is to identify some of those fundamental issues that we need to address. In the 1980s, working as a probation officer in Bootle, Merseyside during a period of mass unemployment, I was confronted by a new problem, a heroin epidemic. And that spread rapidly across some of the most deprived areas of the UK. And the dominant discourse that surrounded problematic drug use at the time was clear and it was robust. Illegal drug use was inherently dangerous. Something about the illegal drugs brought about misery and downfall in people's lives. It would lead to addiction. It would ruin them and it would destroy their families and their communities. The remedy to this social threat of this drug epidemic in that time was to unite communities together and unite the various agencies together against this new enemy called drugs, and to rally all the resources possible to save people who used illegal drugs and to get them clean and to get them off drugs. And I was encouraged, and I did use whatever coercive means possible to save these people and to save the communities. And lots of people lots of groups were formed during that time with Against Drugs in their title. And I want to deconstruct what we understand by drugs this evening, because I'm not sure that we have an accurate understanding of drugs. But I embraced this flawed and misguided dominant discourse. I was part of the Heroin Screws You Up and Saving People from the ravages of illegal drugs. But fortunately, I quickly learned from this mistake that it was my experience of pressurising and persuading drug-using offenders and drug users to give up illegal drugs and to drive them in my car across the country to detox centres or to drug rehab centres, only to see them a few weeks later walking on the street to Bootle. And what I realised is that they were then in a bigger mess after my intervention. The crusade to rid them and the community of illegal drugs and to pressurise them actually did more harm than good, and I could see that. In particular, it didn't meet people where they were at. It didn't listen to what they were ready or able or wanting to do. I was delivering, as a practitioner, my agenda, not their agenda. I was setting them up to fail, and it created conflict and relationship breakdown, which didn't help their progress when they do or are ready for change. It encouraged deceit and it placed drug users more vulnerable and more at risk. And I realised that the drive for abstinence, which I was pushing, needed to be replaced with harm reduction. Harm reduction doesn't exclude abstinence. If somebody is ready, willing and able and wants to pursue abstinence, I was very keen to help them to achieve that. But the starting point was always harm reduction. So the anti-drug campaign in the UK to ensure drug-free lives and establish drug-free communities, it did soften a bit in the late 1980s as harm reduction was eventually preferred to abstinence. But that wasn't so much because, as I've explained, that harm reduction was good practice with drug users. That was much more to protect the wider community from the threat, the greater threat, not just drugs, but the much greater threat of HIV/AIDS. In 1998, the UN hosted a General Assembly, a special session under the official slogan. So they had a special assembly and it was attended by Bill Clinton. And it was under the slogan, "A drug-free world, we can do it." Now I think the notion of a 10-year plan for a drug-free world is far-fetched. It might be a bit akin for me proclaiming that my aim now is world peace by 2024. And it's a nice idea, but I'm not even sure that a drug-free world is a nice idea. I think a world peace would be a wonderful idea. And by the way, I've never taken an illicit drug in my life. So this is true, seriously. That is true. But I've never ever in my life taken an illicit drug. And this is being recorded and everyone can check and whatever. It's true. So I'm not. My agenda this evening is pragmatic and policy driven, based upon practice and experience. It's not based on some liberal approach towards embracing illicit substances. But for me, the notion of a drug-free world, we can do it, is an ideologically driven crusade, one that is irrational, contradictory, unachievable, and I would argue undesirable. And I hope that you can see by the end of this lecture that yes, it would be undesirable. But more on that later. The launch of the UN campaigns was soon followed by a UK appointment of Keith Halliwell, an ex-chief police officer, who was appointed in a US-style drug czar, and he made a 10-year plan as well. And this shift also marked some other changes, a move back again towards abstinence. It marked a shift with greater alignment to US drug policy, but it also placed criminal justice at centre stage for tackling and dealing with drugs as opposed to the NHS. And in 2000, following a number of research studies I was involved in with drug users, I published an article with a colleague, Lee Young. And I, in this article, "A War on Drugs, A War on Drug Users," a title that I actually no longer agree with, which I'll come to later. But this article reflected that the prohibitionist tough law enforcement anti-drug policy, which meted out severe punishments for drug violations, was not so much an attack on drugs. It was an attack on drug users, and I still believe that. Not drug users, but illegal drug users. The war on drugs focuses upon specifically large working class communities who have been ravaged by deindustrialisation, who have been damaged by disinvestment, unemployment, poverty, social, economic and political changes that rendered whole communities worthless and useless. I remember working in the Bootle office, and I think we did some survey. It was either 90 or 95% of the people didn't have work that we were currently engaged with at that time. So Bootle Merseyside is one of these classic areas. So in practice, the war on drugs is effectively a war on discarded working class people whose labour is surplus to capitalist requirements. For people growing up in a miserable environment, unable to secure a stake in society and to legitimately access wealth, a drug-centred lifestyle became a solution to their seemingly unresolvable problems and their bleak existence. And drug laws became a new form of social control. Now, some years later, I came across Noam Chomsky, and he gets across the same issues very well. And he says that the drug war is an effort to stimulate fear of dangerous people from whom we have to protect ourselves. It is also a direct form of control of what we call dangerous classes, those superfluous people who don't really have a function contributing to profit-making and wealth. When you call for a war on drugs, you know exactly what you're going to pick up: poor black people. You're not going to pick up rich white people. You don't go after them anyway. In the upper middle class suburb where I live, if somebody goes home and sniffs cocaine, police don't break into their house. Drug laws have targeted the discarded working class, but they have also had, consistently through history, strong racial elements. And here we go back many years. I can't remember the exact date. I think this might be 1908. But it's the New York Times and the connections there with the Negro coke fiends. There's also the connections with the Chinese opium dens. A lot is made of racial groups and drug use, the use of drugs by the other. And the disparities in sentencing are another example, a much more up-to-date and more recent example. Crack cocaine and cocaine are virtually the same drug, apart from one being baked and turned into crystals and smoked. Very, very similar effects indeed. Black people in the US tend to use crack cocaine. White people, like the people in the City of London, and if you have a few notes on you, they're probably covered in cocaine. They will tend to snort cocaine in powder. And what we find is that the black population, 82% were offenders for crack cocaine, but only 18 were white for cocaine. And one of the reasons why you've got so many more black people incarcerated in the USA for cocaine is because you've got to have an awful lot more cocaine powder, 500 grams, compared to only 5 grams of crack, the same drug, which will then attract a minimum mandatory of 5-year sentence. So once you go over those weights, then you are heading towards, and you've got these very different weights. They've subsequently changed those weights because they were regarded as being racist, and a number of black people have been let out of prison, but they've reduced them to 80, a difference from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1. So they're still not even level. The powder cocaine is still a lot less required. But there's lots and lots of examples of the different way in which the drug laws are enforced and people targeted differently. Let's look more closely at the issue of prohibition. Because I want to suggest to you that the prohibition of drugs actually causes an awful lot more harm than the actual drugs themselves. And not only does it cause more harm, it actually is incredibly ineffective at what it's seeking to achieve. I'll give you some evidence. This is when the war on drugs was declared by Nixon in 71. And lo and behold, there's a little correlation there between the steady journey of incarceration of a proportion of US society to a very sharp increase in incarceration after the war on drugs. And as we look around from different countries, I haven't got the stats before me in this lecture, but I know that there's somewhere between 8 to 40 odd percent in every country are incarcerated. People are incarcerated in prisons. In the New Zealand, where I come from, where I live, 11% of the population are there for drug-defined crimes. So when we say people are there for drug-defined crimes, we're not talking about drug-induced or drug-related. We're talking about possession, supply, cultivation. We're talking about it's a crime because we have actually made it a crime, not that any act has been committed, like a burglary or a theft or an assault or, you know, whatever. It's just simply drug-defined crimes. Okay, I must race on. So here you can see the increase in the drug offenders in the US prisons. So you've got the state prisons, the federal prisons and the jails. And you can see the comparison for drug-defined crimes, those supplies and possessions, the people incarcerated for drug-defined crimes has massively increased from 1980 to 2010. A huge increase of people who are occupying the prison for drug-defined crimes. The other side of all this sort of criminal approach in terms of using the police is another form of war on drugs or war on illegal drugs and a form of civil enforcement where drug-free and drug testing is growing out of all proportion. In New Zealand, they now drug test people on benefits, and if they continue to test positive for illicit drugs, cannabis or whatever, then their benefit will be stopped after the second or third. It's a system that has been adopted from our friends in the US of A. And drug testing is carried out by many employers, and often the companies who run the drug testing are often ex-police law enforcement officials now heading up a private company. suggesting how important it is. And there's also lots of business enterprises and opportunities in drug testing, whether it be through urine or whether it be through swabs, through hair samples, or through the most dangerous drug, which is alcohol actually, but it's sobriety bracelets, which are also being used regularly to keep people or to make sure people are alcohol free. So drug free, and this is another growth industry. It might look a bit like a urinal to the men in the room, and it is, because increasingly there was a conference held by the EMCDDA, I think it's last year, and it called together international leaders across the world who are now going to meet and share their papers around urine analysis of illegal drugs in wastewater. So if you want to have a Sheffield Hallam that can boast of being drug-free students, then why not drug test all your students? And by the way, it's my business, and I'm selling shares in drug testing from now on. And we'll also, my partner company will come and test the urine of all the sewers and in the campus, and we'll give you a certificate. And what's all this about? This is all about trying to measure and work out prevalence and drug-free of these illicit drugs. I think it's out of control. But it is something that is being encouraged for prisons quite seriously, and sometimes schools. And this is another form of the war on drugs coming to home. You can buy drug testing kits online, or in the US you can get them companies to test your children. It's meant to be a way of improving parents adolescent relationships. Not, I don't think. But that's what's being suggested. And here, this is in the name of the war on drugs. A 12-year-old girl was strip searched, and that never went as an issue. And here, a good organisation called Release from the UK have said that every 58 seconds in the UK that somebody has stopped and searched in England and Wales for drugs. And of course, these people on the pack of cards there, they're all drug users, illegal drug users. But they didn't get, they like President Barack Obama and other presidents, did not get a criminal record for their offence. But many other people do get criminal records. Again, as I say, it's mainly the working class, the poor and the black and minority ethnic groups. 1.5 million people have got criminal records for drug possession. Drug possession, a criminal record for drugs will have major effects upon your life. And it's not as if the foot is off the gas on the war on drugs. The criminal convictions for possession are growing, and you can see there the orangey colour is the cannabis. So cannabis is growing in the number of people who are being stopped and convicted of drug possession. But you can see the racial disparity again, that in the US, black and white people use drugs at much the same rate, although if you're black, the chances of you being incarcerated are 1 in 3 if you're a male in the US of A, and often for drug-related crimes. And here, black people use drugs at 5.8% compared to white at 10.5%, but you can see the chances of being stopped if you're black for drugs is 45 out of every 1,000 black people compared to 7 if your skin is white. And then you can see when it comes to drugs and it comes to the issue of converting a stop and a charge to a conviction or a caution, that black people are much more likely to be charged rather than cautioned. And then the other problem with prohibition is that it actually makes drug taking very dangerous. So if many of you might have had a glass of wine before. Any of you have a glass of wine before? Would you just raise your hand if you had a glass of wine? Yeah. Now, you were all quite comfortable having a glass of wine. Some of you had two, I noticed, yeah, very quickly. And the wine you had did not have any toxins in. It wasn't mixed with bleach, and it didn't cross your mind that the wine was mixed with bleach. You anticipated if you had a glass of red or white that it was round about 11% alcohol or 13% alcohol. None of you necked back two or three glasses or one glass driving thinking, I'll be okay. Hey, I hope this isn't 80% alcohol. Because that never crossed your mind, because you know with it being legal what you're taking. Now, the trouble with illegal drugs is not because of what's inherent in the drug, it's because it's illegal, that people have no idea the strength. It could be so strong that they overdose. It could be so strong that they overdose and die. They've got no idea the purity. They could be taking bleach, in which case some of you wouldn't be here now. It could be contaminated with other substances. But also, if you were taking something that's illegal, you've got to go underground, which engages you in a criminal underworld, and then some level of paranoia and worry and anxiety, and also maybe some other opportunities that you might be pressured to engage in or to try or do. Then a fourth one is that buying and using and sharing illegal drugs puts you at risk of criminal sanctions. You could end up having to do, you know, community service, or you might end up eventually having to go to prison, which would ruin your life. And once you acquire a criminal record, then your chances of getting into the US of A, as Nigella found out, are quite difficult. And your chances of employment are difficult. Your chances of housing are difficult. Your life chances. The chances of relationships. I mean, I might get a bit of cred here because I've never taken an illegal drug. But if I'd said, oh, yeah, I've got a cannabis conviction, then maybe you don't look at me in the same way, which is sad. I haven't. So do look at me nice. So you also have to use drugs in secret. And we see a lot of deaths occur because people are using drugs in secret. And that's what you have to do when you take illegal drugs, because you are running a big risk because of the illegality and the consequences of illegality. So if you end up in secret, then you're not going to get the help you need. And you also have to hide the nature of your habits. And so if you did develop, those of you who put your hand up for taking alcohol, if you did develop a problem with alcohol, it might not be as stigmatising or as difficult to seek help. But it would be if you were enjoying an illegal drug. Like one of the other problems with prohibition and the war on illegal drugs is that we sometimes have to find ways of sustaining and maintaining this strange position we have with illegal drugs, and often with moral panics or shock horror campaigns, a little bit like bath salts man eats face off other man or whatever. And the man didn't have bath salts, and bath salts doesn't do that to you. Or a little bit like this, you know, marijuana leads to weird orgies, wild parties, and unleashes passion. So if anyone's got any, do... But that was the idea, so we should, you know, this shock, horror, fear, and, you know, weeds is the root of hell. And then you might be familiar with the methamphetamine one, you know, that if you take methamphetamine, then these things will happen. You'll have all these scabs and sores and get itchy, and life will go downhill. In fact, what's normal here when you take methamphetamine, which is a type of speed stimulant drug similar to your Red Bull or your caffeine or your tea, is that when you start taking methamphetamine, it becomes normal to attack elderly people and to rob them. It's complete, utter shock, horror, misinformation and nonsense. And then you also get some major injustices occurring. And again, this is mainly black women, where we had the crack cocaine babies. Anyone remember the crack cocaine babies in the US of A? And, you know, we had this huge monitoring and these crack babies, and we all felt sorry for these babies and whatever. But there's nothing through the longitudinal studies that is able to support the idea that crack has caused these babies to be have low progress. The baby's progress is exactly the same, or I shouldn't say exactly the same because it won't be exactly the same, but is much the same as and similar to all other babies in similar social deprived backgrounds. So if there is some research from it that's worthy, it's that actually poverty leads to major issues for people. There isn't certainly any evidence of crack babies having mental slowing down their mental and intellectual progress in life. It's the same with the heroin babies. When I was working in Bootle at the time, people were saying that, oh, heroin, it's terrible, all these heroin babies. Nobody was talking about the alcohol babies, and they're still not really talking about the alcohol babies, they're talking about the crack babies. But heroin doesn't damage and won't damage a baby. It will make a baby addicted if heroin is regularly used, but that baby will not have any long-term permanent damage. If you regularly use alcohol, a legal drug, which we like to enjoy and we circulate it and supply it at events like this, then that drug, if you're pregnant, can damage your baby and can lead to fetal alcohol syndrome, and it's permanent and it can't be reversed. So we have a strange misinformation and get a little misled And the other one is the crocodile, this flesh-eating zombie drug, which is now the latest thing. And there's no evidence of that. I've seen people who inject drugs who have ulcers and they have big holes in their arms. It's not the flesh-eating drug. It's to do with dirt and injecting and ulcers. But we like to create these monsters all the time. Here we have marijuana, cannabis. What's good about it? Nothing. But let's remind ourselves, you know, that there are some drugs which are actually very good. But whatever you do, there's nothing good about marijuana. But we know with all our images of alcohol and our drugs, that things are actually quite different. And then the other issue with prohibition is that actually tough prohibition tends to lead to further violence. So the tougher the prohibition is, I haven't got time in this lecture, but basically if this guy here is supplying all the people in this room and we take him out, then somebody else is going to move in, but you might still want your business back while you're locked away or whatever, and these other people who are working for you might be a bit miffed. And what you end up with by removing people and getting tougher is actually disrupting a market and leading to further violence. But that's just not, it's not me just saying that. This is a systematic review of the effect of law enforcement on drug market violence, and that systematic review found that the tougher the enforcement, the more violence was experienced in those areas. But it stands to reason, really. And the other issue with prohibition is it has actually destabilised entire countries, and that is huge. There's the gangsters and the cartels, all made very profitable by drugs, but there's also the poor farmers who are driven with little legitimate means to make money, but to sell coca plants and poppy seeds and whatever, poppies. But countries like Afghanistan and Mexico particularly have been well hammered by prohibition. Okay, let me just give you a break from here. I'll just show you a video for a minute, which will bring together some of these points.
Drug use will no longer be tolerated. Marijuana leads to money, leads to greed, violence.
In 1971, US President Richard Nixon coined the phrase, the war on drugs. And for the 40-plus years since, it's been the goal of politicians around the world to destroy the trade in illegal narcotics. But in this series of videos, we're going to show you how the biggest victims of the war on drugs are not necessarily the people who produce and sell them, but the very people the war on drugs was meant to protect. And that is you. Since Nixon's announcement, each subsequent president followed in line with the war on drugs. Harsher sentences were rolled out in the 70s. President Reagan really ramped up the spending, convicting and mandatory minimum sentence in the 80s. And under Bill Clinton, three strikes laws were introduced on a national level. And the number of people in prison because of drugs, even for minor offences, has really shot up. Between the 1920s and the 1960s, about 1 in 1,000 people in the US were incarcerated, and it stayed at a pretty constant level. But in the 1970s, that number started to go up. In the 1980s, that number started going up even faster. It went up so far that by 2008, the number was closer to 1 in 100 people in prison. There are now more than 2.3 million people in prison in the US, and that number's 6 times higher than it was in 1972. To put that in perspective, the US has around 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prison population. And a large part of that is to do with the war on drugs. Some analysts say that's because the war on drugs is more interested in segregating and punishing offenders than educating them. And so the cycle goes on. It doesn't improve society, it doesn't keep crime down, it doesn't rehabilitate or reform, but it does carry on costing you more and more money. So it does beg the question, who does this really benefit? Well, here's one of those peculiarities of the kind of corporatism you see in the States. Prisons are big businesses, and the biggest of those businesses are the Corrections Corporation of America. Not only do corporations like the CCA campaign for more prisons, promising 90% occupation rates, but they also lobby government for harsher laws and longer sentences, to generate more inmates. And here's one example. On Halloween in 2012, in a place called Casa Grande in Arizona, employees of the CCA put a local high school in lockdown while they did a drug sweep. That's a private prison company going into an educational establishment with the hope that they'll find people in possession of drugs. And that is who really benefits.
So there's clearly a war on illegal drug users. I'm no longer sure I'm not comfortable with there being a war against drugs. I don't think society is against drugs or against drug users. To accept the notion of a war on drugs, or indeed a war on drug users, requires us to embrace a framework for drugs that is rooted in the 1950s. And was enshrined in the 1961 UN Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs. Now, this convention was created many years ago, and you can see the people signing there were middle-aged at best, maybe more elderly, I don't know, white men. And in those days, most of the people would be white men who were making decisions. And they were signing a convention which had been bubbling away for many years, many decades. So the thinking in the single convention was to bring together lots of different conventions which had been around for a decade or so. So the thinking was rooted in the 1950s. And that is the same law and the same logic and basis that informs drug policy today in 2014. And it's now looked after by the UNODC, and the UNODC continue. What I'm showing you here is, because what I want to suggest, is that the view on drugs in the 1950s will be in some ways similar in terms of its unacceptability as to the view of other social issues at that time. So if we thought about the view on race, class and gender in the 1950s, and I tried to sell you that today, many of you would probably walk out and say the guy is off his head. The guy is really completely off the wall when he talks about women, black people or class the way he does. If I was peddling a 1950s view, and this was the view, and I've got loads of these which I show in another lecture on discrimination, but women were very much things and objects to look after the man in the home. And we know all about the way in which black people were treated, particularly in the 50s and the 60s. And attitudes to drugs at the time, interestingly, tobacco was not in the convention seen as a drug, or alcohol, or caffeine, and there was a lot of promotion of those substances. See, the problem is that the UN Convention explains that a drug is any substance listed in the convention. So there's no scientific, no pharmacological or rational basis to explain why alcohol, tobacco or caffeine would be separate from cannabis, LSD, cocaine or heroin. As Bancroft has said, there's no pharmacological categories, illicit or medications. There's not even a pharmacological category for narcotic drugs. They are social categories constructed as a political community to treat some substances differently from others. So they are a social construct based upon culture and prejudice and ignorance and dominant ideology at that time. So the United Nations offers a circular argument, and this is from the UNODC definitions. In the context of international drug control, a drug means any of the substances listed in Schedule 1 or 2 of the 1961 Convention on Narcotic Drugs, whether natural or synthetic. In other words, a drug is anything on the list. So how do we know if it's a drug? Because it's on the list. And that's a circular argument. That's similar to the mantra that we might hear, that drugs are illegal because they're dangerous, and the evidence that they're dangerous is because they're illegal. There's no evidence or science behind such statements. It's just a circular, self-fulfilling argument. So what we've embraced and what we are continuing to uphold is a 1950s social construction of drugs which lacks any coherent scientific evidence base. And these global and national drug controls have resulted in significant harms to people and their human rights. Harms arising from gangsters, harms arising from the controlling of drugs, from abuses by the state of drug laws, which mainly impact upon poor and people of colour. And big business has exploited the culture to promote and sell legal and pharmaceutical drugs. Apparently, I'll probably come to it later, but in the US, children, I think it might be between the ages 7 and 16, just under 8% of all children are receiving pharmaceutical drugs for their so-called behavioural problems, ADHD or whatever, or however whatever label has been given. And we know how well tobacco, alcohol and caffeine are sold. But thankfully, there's a momentum to change. And the report from the Global Commission on Drug Policy, a report that was produced by this group of obviously very liberal hippie lefties who are very soft and probably do drugs, and that's why they would produce a report like this. But these are very conservative, very sensible, very reasonable. You've got Kofi Annan, if you spot a few famous faces. You've got Richard Branson. You've got the ex-president of Greece, the ex-president of Switzerland. You've got a lot of respectable figures who are realising the harm being done by this war on drugs. And what they're saying is, forget what Julian just said before about all the other harms and unintended consequences. Is this effective? Is it working? Well, we'll measure whether it's been working or not, because let's have a look at 1998 to 2008, and what we see is opiates have increased, cocaine has increased, and cannabis has increased. So, and what you see is drugs are actually more readily available and cheaper. There isn't much of a difference operating. There is a very significant growth in legal highs which go under the radar, and that's more difficult to measure and quantify. And what they concluded in their report was that the global war on drugs has failed, with devastating consequences for individuals and societies around the world. 50 years after the initiation of the convention and 40 years after Nixon's launch of the US government's war on drugs, fundamental reforms in national and global drug control policy is urgently needed. And I think drug policy needs to be enshrined with two things at its centre. It needs to have at its heart harm reduction and human rights, HR. You need those two things at the centre of good drug policy. And good drug policy is under threat from the dangers of drugs being addiction and drug-related damage, but also the danger from the underworld, from gangsters and people who will profit, but also, as I've illustrated, in danger from the state who will misuse powers, but also in danger from big business, whether that be pharmaceutical companies or the alcohol and tobacco industry, who will exploit and create increased damage rather than to reduce the harm and will diminish human rights. So the notion of drugs that we've got is terribly flawed. And I don't see how we can continue in any pattern or dialogue of drug reform unless we go back to basics and realise that our whole construct of drugs needs to be overhauled. This is what we've currently got. We've currently got drugs, and then we've got the promoted legal leisure substances. And then we've got the legal medications. And these are not called drugs. You speak to grandma or granddad or whatever, or uncle and auntie, and call them a druggie, and they will not buy into it whatsoever. Well, you use alcohol often, you use caffeine often. Yeah, but I'm not a druggie. But caffeine does kill people. Alcohol kills lots of people, and tobacco is one of the biggest killers, about 110,000 in the UK a year. I could talk at more length about the dangers of those legal substances, but I trust you've got a handle on that. Legal medications growing all the time in terms of our need for drugs. Legal highs which are generally, they might look like natural substances in their little packet, but they're usually sprayed with chemicals, and they're designer chemically created drugs with little knowledge of their long-term condition, what the implications might be. One of the good things about something like alcohol or cannabis is it's been around for a very long time. And there are other substances which go under the radar, and I will argue things like sugar and cocoa should be categorised as drugs and are highly addictive and highly damaging to other people as well as the individuals. So we have this strange socially constructed distinction of what we've called drugs And you see the fingernail of the guy there, it's a dirty packet or whatever, it's not in a nice bottle or anything. And it would be like that because it's all underground and that's what happens. That's how you'd be getting your drugs if we gave you drugs instead of alcohol when you came in. It would probably be some sort of underworld experience, as it were. And this is the single convention that's from 1961, and this is the thing I want to point out here is that it says here the most dangerous substances are categorised number 4, and these substances are already listed in number 1, but they're particularly harmful and extremely limited medical or therapeutic value. And what have we got on the right for those substances? We've got cannabis and cannabis resin. Now, I've never taken cannabis, but I know enough about it to say it's a much more benign drug than most of the other drugs.
And I don't understand. You go to the documentary, weed, which...
And in terms of its medicinal benefits, I think it's got huge medicinal benefits, which have been denied by that 1961 convention, which says they are of little benefit. Here is a medical guy, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, and he was an advisor to the White House for many years. For many years, he embraced the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and believed the truth of the UN Single Convention, and that was what he accepted. But he's done a complete U-turn based upon experience. I'll just show you this and give you a quick break again.
As on CNN this Sunday night, Sanjay spent a year investigating the fight over medical marijuana. More and more Americans are using it. Just a few days ago, Washington, D.C. opened up its first medical marijuana dispensary. And CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, joins me. Now, Sanjay, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, God, you've been looking at this for a year, and I want to remind you that in 2009, you wrote a Time magazine article entitled Why I Would Vote No on Pot. You've changed your mind.
I have, and as part of my thinking reason, I've apologized for some of the earlier reporting because I think we've been terribly and systematically misled in this country for some time, and I did part of that misleading. If you look at all the papers that are written in the United States about marijuana, the vast majority of them are about the harm. That we fund studies on harm, we don't fund studies on benefit nearly as much. So it gives a distorted picture. But I didn't look far enough. I didn't look deep enough. I didn't look at labs in other countries that are doing some incredible research. I didn't listen to the chorus of patients who said, not only does marijuana work for me, it's the only thing that works for me. I took the DEA at their word when they said it's a Schedule I substance and has no medical applications. There was no scientific basis for them to say that.
So when New York Mayor Bloomberg was quoted as saying medical marijuana is the greatest hoax of all time, what do you say to him?
I'm surprised. I follow a lot of the mayor's comments quite closely. I listen to those comments as well. He, as part of those same comments, he was saying that the potency of marijuana has gone up. That is true. It has gone up probably over the last several years. But I urge him to look at the scientific papers. I was just looking at them again in preparation for your show. The science is there. This isn't anecdotal. This isn't in the realm of conjecture anymore. I mean, for a long time, we've just ignored these papers. But this was a drug, that was used for thousands of years.
Now, in your documentary, you get into the effects of medical marijuana, which sometimes can be quite instant. It's quite dramatic.
It really can. It works, and it can work very quickly. In fact, let me just show you.
I'll skip that for time's sake, but... So our construct of drugs is flawed. These are drugs, just as cannabis is a drug. These are drugs, and we can become addicted to these things, and they can have damaging effects on our health, on other people. But we've learned not to regard those things as drugs. And I'd suggest to you that really what we knew, if we're going to have drug reform, we've got to understand that actually we're the drug users and that we are all drug users and that drugs will have different effects on different people. So alcohol for user A might be on the low risk category, but alcohol for user B might be on the high risk category. And cannabis might be a lot less damaging for this person, for user B, than what alcohol is. So we all are using drugs, and drugs are very much part of our society. So we've got to move away from this con that somehow or other drug users are a different type of people. These people here have had a great time. And that isn't offensive to say that to you because they're using alcohol. But if I took and gave a slightly different setting and they weren't in a bar and they were in a derelict house And if they weren't perhaps as well dressed or whatever, and they had needles, and they were in exactly the same pose, then you would not sit comfortably with me saying to you, these people have had a damn good time. But I say to students, I show this picture, I say, they've had a great night out. And that's a perception of pleasure which is made palatable and acceptable through this social conditioning around the alcohol industry and around society, that we think that's a measure of a good night out. And it's with legal drugs, but it wouldn't be okay with other drugs. Let me just quickly talk about the cultural accommodation for pleasure, leisure, celebration, occasion with alcohol. Here we have a birthday, 21st, a happy new year, we've got alcohol again. I hope none of these cards offend anybody, by the way, seeing such dangerous drugs being promoted. Because they are dangerous drugs, and here, even if you pass an exam, I mean, I haven't tried, but I bet you can get one for a driving test, you know, which is like ludicrous, really, isn't it? You pass your driving test, congratulations. I must try, have a look. And here one, you know, anniversary, you know, have another drink or whatever. And here's one, I saw this outside in Wellington in New Zealand, not this photograph, but I saw the car. Selling Red Bull, and with Red Bull you can do amazing great things. You get lots of energy and great confidence, which is what cocaine and amphetamine do for you. This is a stimulant drug of the same ilk. Now how would it be if you saw that car saying cannabis and had a big spliff on? Because I don't think, what I'm trying to say to you is I'm not genuinely, I appreciate making a bit of humour, but I'm not genuinely trying to just make a laugh here. I'm trying to make a very serious point about what is it in our construct of drugs that means that doesn't cause offence when people do die of excess caffeine, particularly the high volume stuff, but cannabis would. And let me show you another one. You know, we can sell. I've made this up. This isn't really available. And I wouldn't promote it. I don't promote the previous ones. I'm not trying to promote this. I'm trying to challenge our social construction of drugs. Alcohol is one of the worst substances you can possibly take, and we all enjoy it, you know, and we work out the risks. But cocaine, snorting cocaine, if you saw that in the shops, you'd be in big trouble. Granny or granddad can send you one with alcohol, but if they saw that on your shelf or whatever, and I think it just raises issues. It raises issues about how this can be okay, but that can't be okay. And that's why I think we need to rethink our model of drugs. If we want a more accurate assessment of drugs, not based in some 1950s cultural construct, then here's a piece of research done by Professor Nutt and colleagues. Now, Professor Nutt, another story, he was sacked for this piece of research because he was the chair of the ACND. Difficult on a lecture like this because they're public lectures. Some of you will be experts and know a lot of the stuff I'm talking about inside out, but there'll be members of the public, so I have to keep explaining in one sense. But he was chair of the Government Advisory Committee, and they didn't like what he was saying because he was challenging. But he did this piece of research, and he looked at the impact of drugs, all drugs, including legal and illegal, upon users and upon others. And then, lo and behold, with these researchers, they produced a graph, and this is what they found in terms of the harm caused. And what you see is some Class A drugs are this is a league table. So the most harmful drugs are those on the far left. And you can see alcohol is the worst you could possibly take. And so it raises questions that the Misuse of Drugs Act is not fit for purpose. I'm going to have to move very quickly now.
A few times, your heart...
Okay, there's a video there of a young girl, Charlotte Figgy, F-I-G-I. Look her up on Google, and it's a wonderful story of how young children with severe epilepsy that is life-threatening and where they're having 100 seizures a day, some of those children are responding to cannabis oil. I found it very painful. One of my children has epilepsy, and I've never been able to find anything that can control his epilepsy. And I find it really painful to think that there could be cannabis oil that could have made a difference and may still be able to make a difference. But there's no way of getting access to cannabis because it's listed on that schedule. It makes it really, really difficult to get access to cannabis. And the people are moving to Colorado where it's been legalised. So there's lots of stories like that, but I haven't got time to show them. I'm going to quickly make the most of what's happening in other parts of the world. In Portugal decriminalised all possession of drugs over 10 years ago. No matter what you had, you would not get a criminal conviction for drug possession. And what did they find? They did not find the drugs increased in the Portuguese country there. So you can see Portugal over the period of time, 95 to 2007, and illicit drug use has actually gone down. It has gone down in other countries too, but you would imagine with all that effort of prohibition and law enforcement, something might be effective. What it suggests is that actually law enforcement and making a drug illegal doesn't have much impact at all upon drug usage. So why bother? What they found from this report by Alex Stevens and Caitlin Hughes is small increases reported in illicit drug use amongst adults. It was actually older adults, but not younger adults, interestingly. Reduced illicit drug use amongst problematic drug users. Reduced burden of drug offenders on the criminal justice system, an increased uptake in treatment, and a reduction in opiate-related deaths, infectious diseases. So positive results there. So it's not been a difficult move to make in terms of the outcomes. Have encouraged Portugal to carry on. There's not any issue there. When in the UK, under the advice of the ACMD and of the Police Foundation report, when cannabis was dropped down from a Class B to a Class C after much publicity. Before they did that, the government wanted to increase supply for a Class C to 14 years, which seems very severe, and never reduced it once the cannabis went back up again. But during that period, while cannabis dropped from a B to a C, what you can see in that period is that during that time, when cannabis was a softly relative in terms of classification, use did not go up amongst young people. In fact, use went down. So again, you know, criminalisation doesn't seem to have any impact on use, or little impact on use, and classification doesn't appear to have a great deal of impact on use. If we look at Holland, Holland effectively decriminalised marijuana since 1976, available in coffee shops. In comparison, in the US it carries severe penalties. In the US, 720,000 people were arrested in 2001 for marijuana. That is a picture of a coffee shop. If you're interested to know how dangerous and dodgy they might look and how seedy, that's a coffee shop in Amsterdam. A good piece of research done in the American Journal of Public Health. They compared marijuana use in San Francisco and Amsterdam. One country where there's tough enforcement to one country where the drug can easily be available, or one city where it can easily be available through coffee shops. And what they basically found is that despite the liberal approach in Amsterdam, the usage of cannabis in San Francisco was much the same at every level, on age of onset use, regularly use, start of maximum use. So there was no difference between Amsterdam and San Francisco. So having coffee shops didn't have a detrimental effect. Well, maybe cannabis is a gateway drug. Maybe it led to people going on to heavy drugs in Amsterdam. Maybe they went off cannabis. Whereas all the evidence in Amsterdam says that actually they have a lower proportion of problematic drug users than countries like the UK and the USA. So this is Amsterdam, the Netherlands, down here, the lowest percentage of problematic drug users out of the European countries. So cannabis wasn't opening the door to go and do lots of other drugs and then lose control. And then here we have cannabis use from a UNICEF report amongst children. And what you see, Portugal, where it's decriminalised and people can get hold of all drugs, cannabis use is low. Netherlands, it's just slightly lower than the UK and the US of A. So liberal approaches like Portugal and Netherlands don't appear to be leading to children getting into taking cannabis. In fact, it's the other countries who are tougher where the figures are greater. The Swiss gave out clean heroin to drug users, and they gave out injectable drugs, and they gave them a premise where they can inject drugs. And then the country decided that this is working and we'll roll it out. They had a referendum, and over 60%, I think it was 68% of the people in Switzerland agreed that we'll give free heroin and free injectable heroin to anybody who's an addict in Switzerland because it works. They've seen employment, they've seen people functioning a lot better, a drop in heroin use, funnily enough. And then just to quickly take you back to New Zealand, where they dealt with the legal high problem, And this has received rave reviews, which do concern me, because what this does is it empowers the police to enter and search without a warrant on suspicion of supply, importation or manufacture. So it's, in my view, it's an unnecessary breach of human rights to give police powers to enter without a warrant. Of course, there would be some serious crimes where that might be justified, but I don't think possession of drugs is a serious crime. They also make it a 2-year prison sentence for supplying an unapproved substance. So what New Zealand did is they made every legal high illegal in one fell swoop. And so you can get done if you have an unapproved. And as yet, nothing has yet been approved or regulated. So personal possession, you can also get, unapproved, can get a penalty of $500. So what it's done, I'm concerned about, is it's created an approved and outlawed market, which in many respects is not that different from alcohol, tobacco and caffeine and the other outlawed drugs. So just to finish, to end the drugs apartheid, the problem isn't simply that we've made an economic mistake of driving drugs underground into the hands of the criminal underworld. So it will not be resolved simply by giving the state commercial control. Because the state is part of the problem. Big business is part of the problem. It's not just the criminal underworld. That we've got a drug apartheid. We've got a war between drugs. It's an apartheid we're operating, and we need to break down this war between drugs and name drugs for what they are, as opposed to allowing a whole pile of things to be sold as non-drugs. And drug laws have been used to control the poor. That the commercial promotion of intoxication and the use of legal non-drugs is a serious issue. And what we don't want to see, I'm concerned to see, simply moving cannabis into the commercial realm. That will not deal with the issue itself. The notion of drugs must be based upon a coherent, scientifically informed and consistently applied approach, not media populism. I believe there's a human right for people to self-medicate if they can gain access legally and can afford the medication. That there's a human right to ingest what you want to ingest in your own body without the threat of punishment or imprisonment. And that the tyranny of the state, as John Stuart Mill called it, should be curbed by severely limiting the powers in respect of personal drug use. And that we should decriminalise personal possession of all drugs and decriminalise personal cultivation, production and manufacture. And that would be a good first-based move rather than commercially producing and moving towards regulation in that way. And the litmus test for a good drug policy is to what degree is it able to promote human rights and harm reduction. So thank you very much for your time.
Well, thanks very much indeed, Julian. You've raised a lot of issues there, and we have about 10 minutes for questions from the floor. So who would like to kick us off? Yes.
I'll declare an interest. David Crompton, Chief Constable here in South Yorkshire. I suppose, can I say first of all, thanks.